It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll hear about some of the fascinating artifacts found when cities decide to expand their underground transit systems with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak. First, President Obama unveiled the country's most significant action ever taken on climate change today. The Clean Power Plan is intended to cut carbon emissions from the power sector by 32% by 2030 from 2005 levels. Opponents in the energy industry have vowed to fight the plan. This is the president speaking earlier today.
Today, after working with states and cities and power companies, the EPA is setting the first ever nationwide standards to end the limitless dumping of carbon pollution from power plants.
Here with us to talk about it is Valerie Volkovici, reporter at Reuters, covering climate and clean energy policy. Valerie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. Good to be with you.
So what is the president's new plan for cutting carbon emissions?
Right. So as we heard from the clip, this is one of the biggest plan that the president has had to target carbon emissions from power plants. And power plants are the biggest source of carbon emissions in the country. So the plan seeks to slash carbon emissions from all of the country's power plants by 32%, which is the equivalent of taking 166 million cars off the road, just to give you a comparison. And it does so by setting targets for each state to ratchet down the amount of carbon their power plants pollute. And they can do so through a series of different options, and they have the choice to pick what works best for them.
What kind of options are there?
Sure. Well, one option that is clear is the Obama administration wants to see more renewable energy come online. So states can ramp up the amount of wind and solar power that they deploy to their grid. States can also take advantage of energy efficiency programs, and that can count towards compliance with the rule. In addition, things like preserving a nuclear plant that's been online or emissions trading. States can work together to trade emission permits, and that's one thing that utilities have done with other air pollutants. There have been pollution trading programs that they've been able to use, so that's an option for them as well.
How big is this plan compared to the president's earlier attempts to limit carbon emissions?
Well, this is the biggest plan to date. This is also very complex in how it's done. Every state will take a different approach to complying, and it does target the biggest single source of emissions in the country.
Now, since this targets the states and they have an array of options to choose from in reaching compliance with this, are we also expecting a variety of reactions in terms of whether or not states think it's feasible with these options or not?
Yeah, absolutely. And the pushback on this rule, since it was first proposed last June, has been intense. It's really the focus of several states where coal had been a big player. It is definitely a concern to manufacturing industry and to mining industry. We've already had the National Mining Association threatening to block the rule in the court. And Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and the Senator of Kentucky has encouraged all 50 governors not to comply with the rule. It's a very partisan issue in Washington, and it's one that definitely sparks a lot of debate back and forth.
So you said partisan. Does that mean that this essentially breaks down between supporters and critics along party lines?
What we've seen so far sharply, in my inbox I've been getting lots of comments from different lawmakers, and on the federal level, yes, it's been by party lines. But I think in the states, I think it will vary. I think you'll see some in some state governments, there might not be as strong opposition, but those states may have an easier route to their target than others.
We're talking right now with Valerie Volkovici. She's a reporter at Reuters covering climate and clean energy policy. And coal industry representatives have said they expect that this plan is going to drive up energy prices. Did the president respond to those concerns at all today?
Yes, he definitely did. The way that the Obama administration has been presenting this is they've been saying, yes, the plan will cost $8.4 billion a year by 2030. But what they've also been saying is that the benefits of the rule, the climate change benefits and the health benefits, will outweigh those costs. And the EPA had figures out saying that the net benefits would range from $26 to $45 billion. So they're trying to make the case that this might cost money, but it will save money in other ways.
Do we have a sense about why the president is making a move on climate change right now?
Sure. Well, in his first term, President Obama didn't really prioritize the climate change issue. And in his second term, he's really kind of prioritized it. This is a legacy issue for him. And he's kind of going big on climate change as his term ends. But also, in a couple of months, in December, we'll have the big United Nations Climate Change Summit in Paris. And President Obama really wants to take a leadership role in securing this agreement. He's already taken, you know, the first real step at that by getting China to agree with the United States to take some, you know, serious emissions cuts and reduce their emission intensity and eventually wean themselves off of coal.
Now, in the past, the coal industry has said at some of the earlier attempts to limit carbon emissions that it was too much to ask too soon. The transition would be too bumpy. Are there any provisions in this plan to smooth that transitional time as a transfer of energy goes from one source to another?
Sure. Well, one of the big changes to the rule was the EPA pushed back by 2 years to 2022 the first compliance year for for the power plants and for the states. This kind of gives them more time to start adjusting their energy mix, to start bringing new resources online, and to start retiring some of the dirtier power plants. But the administration is also offering incentives to states that kind of get a head start before 2022. So if they'll get credit for bringing renewable energy online or putting in place energy efficiency programs in low-income communities. So they're really trying to reward states that take early action and encourage states to start faster.
Now, you said there's already talk of challenges in court to this plan. Do you have any idea what the basis might be on that?
Sure. There's any number of legal arguments. But one I think will be definitely used is the fact that industry has argued that the Obama administration has overstepped the boundaries of the Clean Air Act. And by not regulating the emissions directly at the power plant, by kind of allowing renewable energy, by allowing these other measures that don't involve putting a scrubber on a smokestack, they're going outside the fence line. And that means that they might be pushing the bounds of the rule. So that might be one of the main arguments that we'll see from legal groups.
Now, this plan, it's being seen as a legacy issue for the president. Will its success or failure be a big feature on his final report card, maybe both here in America and also abroad?
Sure. Yes. And he's really made this a priority in his second term. And the president announced that he's going to be kicking off basically a month-long focus on climate change. He's putting it in the spotlight, and he's basically taking head on some of the climate change deniers that have been attacking some of the regulations that he's put forward. So, you know, I think the international community will be looking to whether President Obama sees this through, is able to help broker this agreement in Paris, and really be able to stand up to some of the opposition that he faces on climate change. That's seen as a weakness in the United States' ability to be a leader in the climate talks, just the amount of dissent that there is at home.
Valerie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
We've been speaking to Valerie Volkovici, reporter at Reuters, covering climate and clean energy policy, talking about President Obama's Clean Power Plan, which was just announced today. NASA announced it had discovered the first near-Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone of a sun-like star. It was quickly called Earth 2.0. That happened earlier this summer. But a story in Discover magazine says there are lots of very large Earth-like planets that could support life out there. Discover magazine editor Gemma Tarlak is with us now to talk about this and other science news, including subway archaeology and things you didn't know about the human voice. Gemma Tarlak is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about the hottest science news. And Gemma, welcome back.
Hey, always great to be with you.
Well, let's start with briefly talking about the cover of the September issue of Discover Magazine. You got a story focusing on archaeological items found during underground transit projects in cities around the world. So it's not just happening in one place. What kinds of items are the builders finding?
Oh, this is a fascinating story, and we really do cover the world with it. The focus of the story is on a Turkish archaeologist who is leading the team that discovered the lost port of Theodosius right in Istanbul. I mean, downtown Istanbul, they found just the largest commercial and military port in early Byzantium. From the 4th through the 11th centuries, they found 37 shipwrecks, some types of ships that had never been found before, and just millions and millions and millions of artifacts. And then underneath all that stuff from the Byzantine era, they found remains of buildings and funerary urns and all other kinds of good stuff dating all the way back to the Neolithic times, telling us that this area was settled way earlier than we thought. And you know, similar subway projects in Rome, in London, and in Rio de Janeiro have also been turning up just incredible archaeological finds. I think my favorite has to be in Rio, because as they're expanding, you know, getting ready for the Olympics, they are expanding a railway line and uncovered 17th to 19th century trash of the aristocracy. Now, you might think, wow, so what? But they found, like, the Emperor of Brazil's toothbrush.
Whoa.
I mean, yeah.
Wait, how do they know it's his toothbrush?
Because it has his name on it. I'm serious.
Of course it does.
You know, if you're the emperor, right, you put your name on stuff.
You don't want anyone to take your toothbrush. I get it.
Exactly.
So it's kind of crazy to think that there are these phantom cities, these preserved sites just beneath these modern-day cities.
It is. And, you know, of course, you kind of think in a city like Rome, for example, oh, it's been settled for so long. It's been such a major city for so many, you know, centuries. They found everything, right? And then it turns out, in the case of Rome, it's right under the Piazza Venezia, which is one of the main, you know, intersections in the city. They found a two-story, well, it's basically a recreation center from the time of Hadrian, with areas, you know, to hear poetry and see plays. And it was right there, right underneath your feet, literally.
Oh, it's amazing. So what's being done now to preserve these sort of little remnants of cities and civilizations?
Well, fortunately, all of the cases that we looked at, the folks who are actually doing the railway expansion kind of budgeted in the fact that they were going to find some archaeological goodies, although most of them didn't really appreciate the scale. But they've budgeted it in, so they're letting the archaeologists go in, preserve, protect. In most cases, they're removing things that they can save. And in a lot of cases, they're actually building museums on site so that, you know, commuters going to and from, they can actually go to a museum and see the loot, basically, that was found where their train station now is.
Wow.
So it's a really cool project.
Are you going to be first in line for a ticket to those museums?
I don't know.
They sound amazing.
I'd like to say I really dig this kind of archaeology.
Well, you just did. All right, well, let's move on to your next story. A nutritional gastroenterologist did an experiment with two groups of people swapping out diets for 2 weeks. And what did he find?
Yeah, this is something that really surprised me. He took two groups, a group of African-Americans from Pittsburgh who are at high risk for colon cancer. And then he took a group of rural South Africans who are at very low risk for colon cancer. And for 2 weeks, he switched their diets. So the folks in Pittsburgh got to eat a lot of yams and a lot of beans. The folks in rural South Africa, they got to eat the cheese and macaroni and cheese and the cheeseburgers and the bacon. And how about some bacon on top of that bacon? Typical American diet. And after only 2 weeks, he found that each group had taken on the colon cancer risk markers of the other group. So in other words, the rural South Africans, traditionally at very low risk for colon cancer, they had an uptick in all the biomarkers showing you're at high risk for colon cancer. And the situation was reversed for the folks in Pittsburgh. They were suddenly at a much lower risk for colon cancer. After 2 weeks.
I guess the astounding thing in either direction, good or bad, depending on how you slice it, is how quickly that change happened.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, I asked the researcher about that, and this is something, he's a gastroenterologist, and this is something he deals very closely with for his, you know, entire career. And he said, actually, yeah, 2 weeks is pretty much how long it takes for your body to really register a change in diet, which I think is, you know, good news for all of those among us who want to be happier and healthier.
And maybe bad news if you go on a two-week binge and think, oh, it's only a couple weeks. Of course, a binge lasting 2 weeks is quite a while. So do we know yet what aspects of the South African diet led to those? Was it the beans? Was it the fiber? What made the positive change?
Yeah, that's actually the next stage of the research. Now that they know a high-fiber, low-fat, low-meat diet lowers your risk for colon cancer, he's going to go back and study each aspect. So studying just the high fiber, just the low fat, just the low meat, to really kind of narrow in on what is the best, you know, best course to take forward.
We're talking right now with Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, getting the latest in science news right now. And we're going to talk now about exoplanets. NASA found an Earth 2.0 that was earlier this summer. And you have a story out there, though. There are a lot of planets that could support Earth out there called super Earths, not just maybe this one. What do we know about these would-be super Earths?
Well, you know, there are probably about 2,000 exoplanets out there. And for a long time, astronomers were thinking, yeah, it's going to be a planet that's our size, a planet that is our distance from a sun like ours, et cetera. But now they're looking at this class of exoplanets they're calling the super Earths, which, very loosely defined, it's any planet with up to 10 times Earth's mass. So we're talking about some pretty big planets out there, but they're looking at these and thinking, actually, if they are the right distance from the right kind of star, they might just be even better for harboring life than Earth is.
And so, you know, we heard a lot several years ago about the Goldilocks zone, how it's a miracle that the Earth resides in this one sweet spot in the solar system. Are we then discovering that there are other sweet spots, and maybe a lot of them?
Absolutely. In fact, the planet you mentioned, Earth 2.0, it's officially Kepler 452b, which is not nearly as catchy, but let's just call it Kepler 452b for now. That is a really good example of a super Earth because it's about 60% larger than our planet, but it orbits a sun just like ours, and its orbit is 385 days, which is pretty close to ours. So far, it is kind of the closest of all the super Earths we've found that is closest to Earth. So they're really excited about the habitability that they might find there for life.
How do we find these planets, and what are the odds of us being able to jet there one day?
Oh, don't pack your bags yet. Let's start there. But all of these discoveries really are coming from the Kepler Space Telescope, which is just mind-boggling how much great data it's given us over the years. In this case, they spot the planets by what's called transits. They're looking at a star, and they're gauging how bright the star is, getting all that data, and then suddenly there's a dip in brightness. And they look really closely at the data about that dip in the star's brightness, and that's actually a planet crossing in front of it. And they can tell, believe it or not, from that tiny dip in brightness that registers, they can get a really good sense of how far the planet is from that star, how large the planet is, sometimes even its composition.
And finally, Gemma, we're going to wrap up by talking about the human voice. That's the final page of your magazine. Lots of interesting facts, including a little section on Tuvan throat singing. And just so we know what we're talking about, let's listen first, and then you can tell us why it's kind of a miracle. An example there of Tuvan throat singing. Why is that so remarkable, Gemma?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, in the West, we really focus on a single pitch at a time, single tone at a time. But Tuvan throat singers, and there are a few varieties of throat singing out there, they all kind of work the same. Tuvan throat singers operate kind of like bagpipe players do. They first create a low drone, and then they're able to layer on 1 to 3 additional tones. And they do that by maintaining the drone, which you heard pretty clearly in that sample, and then they manipulate their vocal folds and the root of their tongue, the flap of cartilage at the base of the tongue, and they're able to create simultaneous tones. And that was why I believe you heard just one singer there. Mm-hmm. And he's layering all these tones on top of this drone that he starts with. So it's a fascinating, just a fascinating sound, and I love it. But it just shows you how versatile a human voice is.
And as we wrap up, what are one or two of your other favorite facts about the human voice?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I am fascinated by language, and it really threw me for a loop when, you know, English has about 40 distinct sounds. Well, the most complex language currently spoken on the planet, spoken in Botswana, I'm not even going to tell you the name of it because I will totally mangle it, but they've got 112 distinct sounds, almost three times as many as English does. Yeah, crazy. So I love that, and I love that the record holder for the lowest note sung by a human, it's a singer named Tim Storms, he sings 8 octaves below the lowest G on a piano. This is the part I love. We can't verify that by listening to him. He had to sing, and they had to capture it with a low-frequency microphone and then verify it through sound analysis.
Wow.
It's so low, it's out of our hearing.
That is crazy. Well, Gemma, thank you so much for coming on and giving us so much to chew on today.
Oh, always a pleasure to talk with you. Have a great day.
You too. Well, that was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about the latest science news. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. At tomorrow evening's Madison Common Council meeting, Mary Paul Soglin will ask council members to consider a proposal that will further limit where and for how long people who are homeless can congregate in downtown Madison. Soglin laid out his reasons at a press conference on Thursday for the limitations he's proposing on time spent on downtown benches and for sleeping in other central areas. The mayor said that Madison is currently copying the failed policies of West Coast cities like San Francisco and Portland, Oregon. Paul Skidmore has represented the city's 9th district on the Madison Common Council since April of 2001. He supports the mayor's proposal, and he's here with us in studio to tell us why. Representative Skidmore, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, can you tell us exactly what the mayor is proposing for people who are homeless who may congregate downtown?
Well, first off, I'd like to say that this is a proposal that's geared toward behavior, not a class, and that there have been problems downtown long before there were a homeless issue. The issue with the homeless has become significant in the last year, but there have always been behavior problems, and now there are very significant problems with loitering, aggressive panhandling, disorderly conduct, physical assaults, which have become regular. Some people would like to argue that this is being directed at the homeless. No, it's not. It's being directed at the behavior which makes the downtown unsafe.
Do you consider those behaviors a large enough proportion that they warrant this action?
Yes, I do. Many other groups agree with me. Downtown Madison, I believe, has weighed in on this. I believe the Convention and Visitors Bureau is going to be weighing in on it very shortly. Yes, a lot of people do. I hear from a lot of my constituents, and you know, I'm somewhat surprised some of my colleagues say that there's overwhelming opposition to it. I haven't heard much, if any, opposition to it.
Now, is the vote happening tonight?
No, it's not. The ordinance is being introduced for referral, which means it's going to go to some committees, maybe added to another couple committees. It'll be debated and recommended by these committees, and then it'll come back to the council for a vote. The introduction means it will be officially considered. It's a formality. There will be no discussion at the meeting.
Now, local advocates for people who are homeless have said that the mayor's proposal lacks compassion as they see it. How would you respond to that charge, that this is not a compassionate policy?
It's a policy that's geared toward behavior, and I guess I would have to ask, how can you argue in favor of behavior that's illegal and not allowed in other parts of the city? We're talking trespassing, loitering, obstructing sidewalks is an ordinance violation. Defecating in public is an ordinance violation. Assault. These are all ordinance violations that warrant a sanction. So why should we allow it here? It's gotten to such a point downtown that people are afraid to use the area. My wife will not come downtown for this reason. A lot of people will not come downtown, particularly at night, because it's not safe.
Now, people who may be experiencing homelessness may not have the luxury of choice, of an option of where to go. What is the city doing in terms of bigger projects to help address the overarching issue of homelessness in Madison?
That's a good question. This is not just a city issue. It's a city, county, state issue. Everybody has a stake in it. The city puts over $2 million a year into homeless programs. And in addition to that, those are short-term programs that we put money into every year. In addition to that, the mayor's got a number of initiatives. The one that I'd like to point to is Housing First, where we're trying to build transitional housing and housing to get people off the streets. There are programs for that. Rathke is being built on the east side in my district. There's one that's been proposed. It's going to be introduced again to see if there's WIDA funding. So there are short-term and long-term proposals. The long-term is going to get people into housing. Long-term. Another thing, which is something exciting that happened this week, is that the county is a major player in this. We are working with the county to build or to locate and develop a day center. That's not a simple issue. That's not something that you can snap your fingers and make happen. But there's some ideas that are being floated right now that you've heard of just off of East Washington, that which could happen. Also, the county just received designation from the state today that their Human Services Department has been officially designated to provide mental health counseling and substance abuse counseling, which is very, very important for many individuals, including homeless. That's a county responsibility. They've secured this. They've stepped up to the plate, and we're very grateful for that. So there are long-term and short-term proposals. This is not an easy fix. But one thing we have to realize is that there has been a significant influx within the last year of homeless population into the city.
Why is that?
I'm not the best person to discuss that. The mayor and others have opined that we've become a magnet for homeless, because there's a reputation out there that come to downtown Madison. There are no rules. You can't get arrested. So there's a lot of homeless programs. I think the mayor said there's at least 37 separate programs with entitlements for homeless, food, bicycles. Porchlight has a wonderful service for their day shelters, their overnight shelters. There are three within the area. There are many beds that are open. Many people choose to sleep on the street.
We're talking right now with Paul Skidmore, who represented the city's 9th District on the Madison Common Council since April of 2001, talking about a new proposal from Mayor Paul Soglin to limit time that the homeless and homeless people experiencing homeless, sometimes it's a temporary state, often it is, can congregate on benches and other places like that downtown. You said people choose to sleep on the streets. Why would that be? What data do you have to back that up?
The mayor has done research, and he has talked with Porchlight and the director there and others, and he's talked to people out on the front porch of City Hall. They choose to stay there. One of the reasons that they may choose not to go into a homeless shelter is that you must abide by their rules. Number one, you can't be drunk, you can't exhibit very bad behavior, and you can't be under the influence of a controlled substance, an illegal controlled substance. Other people, have been placed in housing, yet they are thrown out because of bad behavior, because they, intimidate other tenants, or they just simply can't do it.
Now, the mayor has said that he thinks Madison is emulating cities with failed policies dealing with people who are homeless, cities like San Francisco and Portland, Oregon. Do you have any idea of what sort of policies that you, maybe the mayor, think should be emulated that we can take examples from other cities from?
Well, he's looking at the Boston model, and we may be trying to bring some people from Boston out to talk to us about that. He's got a kind of a core idea, which I agree with. It says rules or compassion without rules or responsibilities is going to fail. If you're compassionate and keep giving and giving and giving, and that there's no rules of conduct that people are have to adhere to, then it's going to fail, because why should you? There's no consequence. if you're not called on your bad behavior, your assault. I just talked to a business owner that I work for on Saturday who said that an aggressive panhandler grabbed him and wouldn't let him go, and he had to call the police. Well, the police were so busy, they weren't able to respond. They got there 45 minutes later. That's the kind of behavior that creates a situation which is dangerous.
Now, Wisconsin is not an easy state in which to experience homelessness. It's got a very cold winter a lot of the time. Are you concerned at all that policies that move in this direction could result in physical harm or risk to safety of people who are experiencing homelessness?
I think that the city and the county are committed to working toward ending homelessness. So I would say no. I mean, there are programs available. As I said, that there are shelters, overnight shelters, that have beds available if people are willing to abide by the rules. And that's what part of the Boston model is, that we will do everything we can to help you and find you a home. We'll get you off your addiction. We'll help you with your mental illness. We will help you with many things, but you have to abide by the rules.
And what is the most important aspect of this issue that you hope comes out in these discussions and proposal?
The nexus of what I'm considering is, this is not an either-or proposal. This is a both-and. We need long-term work, and that both the city and the county are stepping up to do that. And I think the county should be recognized for what they're doing. The city should be recognized for what they're doing. We have to keep doing the long-term projects, like Housing First. But we also have to keep in mind that this is a city where a lot of people live, and when it gets right down to it, there's only a handful of individuals, and by handful, maybe 100 to 150, that are exhibiting the behavior which is really egregious. If we can control the behavior, we're going to have a much better city, and we can manage the bigger situations, too. It's a both and.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking to Paul Skidmore, who's represented the city's 9th district on the Madison Common Council since April of 2001. We just heard from a supporter of Madison Mayor Paul Soglin's proposal to cut down on the time that people who are homeless will be allowed to congregate in the state capitol's downtown area. Joining us now are Karen Andrew and Al Muhaiman. Karen is the Director of Outreach Services for the First United Methodist Church in downtown Madison. She also serves as chair of the Homeless Services Consortium of Dane County. Also with us is Al Muhaiman. He's a homeless advocate who has himself experienced homelessness. Karen, Al, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Well, Karen, the mayor's proposal would limit the time that can be spent on public benches downtown, would severely curtail the time that people are allowed to sleep in those public areas. What would this mean for Madison's homeless population?
Well, I think the idea of implementing an ordinance to keep track of how long an individual is on a bench, whether they're homeless or not, is very difficult, not only to monitor and the time that it would take, apparently, to have our police officers in the central district monitor that we could be spending time talking about the real issues. Monitoring time on a park bench is not going to address the complex issue of homelessness.
And Al, we heard from the representative that he saw this as a behavior issue. This was targeting certain behaviors, not a group of people. He was seeing things that he considered threatening and, in other cases, difficult for the city of Madison to manage. Do you see it as that way? Do you think there is a behavior issue?
Well, I think there's a behavior issue because you have clients that are mentally unstable. You have people that do have the alcohol and drug addictions. But, you know, it's the ones that are psychologically unbalanced that kind of cause all the problems, like the defecating in public and stuff like that. But, you know, when they look at that, they look at all homeless people as with an unstable problem.
So do you think that an ordinance like this is the right way to address those behavior issues?
No, I don't think that is right, because for the simple fact, I have a mobility issue where I use for walking. I periodically have to stop and sit down. And for them to tell me how long I can sit on the bench, you know, that's kind of like stereotyping against the homeless, because I understand the city is about revenue. you know, as far as the politics that go on with it. And a lot of aldermen and whatnot own businesses up and down there. The target is that they don't want you to stick out like a sore thumb because you're sitting there with a bunch of bags, or, you know, you're just sitting there because you see a cool spot.
And Karen, what do you think about the ordinance in terms of how the resources might come into play here? Does Madison have the resources to support homeless people? And if not, is an ordinance like this one of the ways that it makes rational sense to go?
I have two-part response to your question. First of all, to address any issue that is an illegal activity, such as panhandling, disorderly conduct, assault, whether that be by a homeless person or a sheltered individual, whether that be by an addicted person or a non-addicted person, or an individual struggling with mental health issues, a crime is a crime and a violation is a violation. That behavior is addressed in and of itself, and it is not a correlation or causation of sitting on a bench for over an hour. So to meet a person where they're at, when we talk about street outreach, whether that be a briar patch or a tellurian or a porch light or a volunteer outreach provider such as Friends of the State Street Family or the Stone Soup Squad, those individuals are doing what we call street outreach and building relationships. So the foundation of all is building trust, meeting somebody where they're at, and working to reduce harm. So if somebody is, let's say, addicted to alcohol, working with them on that particular issue, that is street outreach. And I would like to see our Madison Police Department work on street medicine, partnering with advocates and police to implement street medicine. And I reference Dr. Jim Withers out of Pittsburgh, who has drastically reduced homelessness to address the issue at hand.
Now, we talked with Paul Skidmore about whether or not, this being Wisconsin and being a difficult climate sometimes in which to experience homelessness, there could be any public safety concerns for the people who are experiencing homelessness. Do you see that as an issue, especially if Madison moves toward tougher policies, more rules?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind when we talk about a person's safety is a capacity of shelter. We don't have capacity in Madison. And, I mean, Porch Light has a limited number of beds. The Salvation Army has a limited number of beds. The domestic abuse location has a limited number. So we're waiting for the doors to open on a youth shelter. Those doors have not opened. We do need to look at the real numbers of folks who are experiencing homelessness here in Madison, and then look at the capacity of beds. And when we do limit days in a shelter, it's because we don't have enough beds.
And Al, we heard that some people, according to the mayor, may choose to sleep outside instead of in one of these shelters. Does that square with what you've seen, what you've experienced?
No, that is totally incorrect, because for the simple fact is that you only get 60 days in the shelter. And once you use those 60 days up, you know, then that means that you have to be out here, like the summer months. Most of the people that are out here because they don't have shelter days, or it can be close for them to time to use. If they use days now, those days count against them in the winter time. So that means that a lot of them are trying not to be stuck outside in the winter because they have no days.
And in terms of staying safe while you're experiencing homelessness, do you have a sense about whether it's safer in a shelter or sometimes safer on the streets?
Well, it's most definitely safer in the shelter because I got here 2 years ago after my wife, who was also homeless, died in my arms in Iowa City, Iowa.
I'm sorry.
You know, and it was in the middle of winter, 40 below zero, and I almost lost my life. So definitely you would want to be in a shelter, but how can you be in a shelter if the shelter's overcrowded and they don't have the room to put you in?
Karen, what are some solutions and options that the Homeless Services Consortium would like to see considered as this becomes a big issue in Madison?
Well, we would like to talk about housing first in action and not words. So what that means is landlords opening up a capacity to rent to folks who are currently homeless. So some of these things are making it really difficult for consortium members and leadership in our community to have crucial conversations with owners of properties, to hear things that are inflated and examples that are given to stereotype a class of individuals. it makes it all the more difficult. And it's kind of like putting a barrier up when really, if we can sit down and talk about harm reduction, and those of us who work in all of our jobs, I'm sure with your job, you work with compassion and passion as I do, but that doesn't mean we don't have rules. I keep hearing compassion without rules. So I just wanted to respond about that, in that everybody I know and every service provider, we all operate within boundaries. We have boundaries, we have rules. That does not mean we don't have compassion. We can have both.
Now, we'd like to give you the last word. What's the most important aspect of policy that affects people who are homeless that we need to remember?
You know, being homeless here in Madison, you know, it has taught me to humble myself and be thankful for the very agencies that helped me, like Porch Life, First United, Bethel. And, you know, I have, you know, move or made progress to try to eliminate my homeless status because I just got the Section 8 voucher. But as far as the housing, it's like, you know, it's non-existent because it's this kind of discrimination. They want me to make 2 to 3 times my income, and I can't do it. But I'm trying. But, you know, it's just a problem that needs to be addressed.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us today and coming up to the studio.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking there with Karen Andrew and Al Muhaiman. Karen Andrew is the Director of Outreach Services for the First United Methodist Church in downtown Madison. She serves as chair of the Homeless Services Consortium of Dane County. Joining us also in studio, Al Muhaiman is a homeless advocate who has experienced homelessness himself. Some sad news today for humanity. Hitchbot, the cheerful and chatty hitchhiking robot from Canada, met a sorry end in Philadelphia. The robot had already been hitchhiking all over the world, across Canada and Europe, with nary an incident. Hitchbot's founders wanted to create a robot that was lovable and would survive on human kindness. Founder Frauke Zeller said, "Usually we're concerned with whether we can trust robots. This project asks, can robots trust human beings?" The answer? I guess not. After clocking thousands of safe miles in other countries, Hitchbot hit U.S. soil, logged only 300 miles here, and was found decapitated in a Philadelphia gutter. There's pictures online if you're curious. It's a sad sight. Nick Lowe, with his commentary on the matter in his song Peace, Love, and Understanding, brings us out.
As I walk this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity, I ask myself, is all hope lost? Is there only pain, hatred?